This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter by McDonald Hastings. In this program, McDonald Hastings, journalist, war writer, and broadcaster, gives you the feel of life here in London and highlights the personalities in the news. Here is McDonald Hastings.
This is McDonald Hastings from London. For a long time now, political commentators on both sides of the Atlantic have been prophesying that the next United Nations conference, the conference that was agreed, you remember, at San Francisco, people have been saying that the next conference will be held in London. And it's no secret that in Washington, London has been the first choice. From every viewpoint, for its convenience as an international center, for its world network of communications, for its vast size, and above all, for the unparalleled experience which London has in organizing and handling great international gatherings, from every practical viewpoint, the British capital was an obvious choice. And I like to think that sentiment also, if there is any sentiment in international affairs, if there isn't, there ought to be, I like to think that the proposal to hold the next United Nations conference in London was also inspired out of recognition of London's grim stand for liberty, of the days when we fought alone, of the years when London was the rallying place of the flower of the fighting men and the metropolis of the hopes of all the free peoples of the world. To have held the second United Nations conference here would have been a pretty compliment, and for us Londoners, a proud one. But between you and me, in spite of what your favourite columnist, may say about it, I think it's very unlikely to happen. Wherever the second United Nations conference is held, my personal bet is San Francisco again. Wherever it's held, I'm afraid it won't be old London. The reason isn't that anybody has opposed the suggestion, quite the contrary. The sad reason is that London is still too battered, too short of food, too short of transport, too short of manpower, too short of accommodation to entertain on the scale that London is used to and that important visitors to London have a right to expect. I don't know the sort of letters that diplomats send to each other, but if London was a hostess, I can imagine her writing cheerfully, "Dear folk, we'd love to have you, but the roof is down, the servants have all gone away, we haven't got a motor car to fetch you from the station, there's nothing to eat in the larder, and well, you know what this climate's like when the central heating isn't working properly. But will you please invite yourselves again in a few years' time when we've had a chance to pull ourselves together?" And that's how it is. The housing shortage, now that people who evacuated themselves are returning to London, is so serious that it seems possible that the government may have to use compulsory powers to commandeer property. The fuel situation, heat and light, is going to be more critical this winter than at any time during the war. There's never been a greater shortage of clothes and shoes. For the first time, shops are unable to supply some goods, even in exchange for coupons. We've had to accept further cuts in food rations. The fat ration now is only 4 ounces of margarine, 2 ounces of butter, and 1 ounce of lard a week. The public transport services are so starved for men and vehicles that workers have to queue to get between office or factory and home. And the coming of hundreds of delegates to an international conference with all their staff, secretaries and so on, at this time, well, it would be frankly more than we could manage and keep an even keel. It's tough. It's the price of victory. And wherever the second meeting of the United Nations is ultimately held, well, we in London shall be satisfied, as long as the international delegates keep ever present in their minds what war cost.
Make sure that when they make plans for world peace and prosperity this time, they make it good.
But it's probably puzzling you why we're in such a pickle anyhow. After all, cessation of lease lend, the tremendous outpouring of British wealth during the war, the consequences of the Blitz, they can't be the whole story. And that's true enough. It isn't the whole story. Although, make no mistake about it, the consequences of war destruction and war expenditure on one side and the consequences of the peacetime cessation of lease lend on the other Those two factors do add up to a situation where we're getting the worst of both worlds at present.
So much so that some bitter wit wrote a letter to one of the London papers the other day, suggesting that if the RAF would only drop a few more bombs on us, it would at least stop people calling the time we're having now peacetime. But in spite of all that, the root cause of our present trouble does go deeper. The greatest problem in Britain today is manpower. Labour to build the houses, labour to make civilian goods again, labour to make the exports we must have to trade with the world for food. Whatever else happens, there's one social evil that Britain hasn't got to think about for years. Unemployment. Our greatest domestic trouble is just the reverse to your domestic trouble. Your worry is to find an outlet for your surplus goods to keep America's manpower fully employed. Our trouble is to find the manpower to meet an unparalleled demand for goods. You fight the prospect of unemployment, we fight the prospect of scarcity. It's crazy, but that's the way the world is. And sooner or later, the world has either got to pull itself together or go to war again, because it's paradoxes like that. One naughty little nation with a tummy ache from trying to eat too much cake, and another naughty little nation with tummy pains because it hasn't got any cake to eat at all. It's digestion troubles like that which are the very factors which make Tweedledum go to war with Tweedledee. Indeed, that everyone's going to have an equal share of the cake is the favourite apologia of the would-be world conqueror. How did all that start? Yes, it started through my saying that Britain's greatest shortage at the moment is manpower. And if you could see the London papers now, you'd read about it on every page. Every one of the four pages, which is the wartime limit, which is still in force. You'd read that tons of fish were rotting on some quay because a mere 150 skilled packers couldn't be hired for love nor money. You'd read that Birmingham had had to turn down foreign contracts for millions of dollars because although she had the machinery and the material, she hadn't the men to handle. You'd read that public transport can't be increased because there aren't the men to operate the vehicle. And if you turn to the small advertisement column, you find half a dozen offers of unskilled labour under the jobs wanted column, and the jobs vacant are screaming lists from desperate employers trying to hire hands to turn their businesses over to peacetime production. Where are the men? In the armed forces, most of them, and the rest involved in the inevitable muddle of what labour experts call redundancy, meaning that the labour, suddenly paralysed in war factories, hasn't had time yet to go through the industrial sieve and find down in new areas, in new factories for normal peacetime production. But demobilisation is the great problem, the greatest problem which Britain's new Labour government has to battle with at the moment. Until the men are released, all the other plans for Britain's future reconstruction, trading policy and social programme must wait. Manpower comes first. And already, the Mr. Attlee's government are under popular fire because there's a feeling, even among the rank and file of the new Labour members of Parliament, that the government isn't getting on with the job courageously enough or quick enough. It's being said with some acerbity that the service chiefs are overestimating their requirements. Those on the home front are complaining that their time is being wasted in service life. But so far, the Labour government is clinging to the demobilisation plan which was put forward under Mr. Churchill's regime. A plan which insists that men must be released according to their demobilisation category, whatever part of the world they're in, and according to their age and length of service. That means that men in uniform on the home front, even though they may be redundant in the services, have to wait their turn with the men in the European armies of occupation in the Far East. It's the fair way of doing things. But the critics of the plan are asking if, in view of the grave manpower situation, it's the wisest thing to do. The supporters of the Bevin plan, as it's called, Bevin plan because it was originally introduced in Parliament by Ernie Bevin, who is now foreign minister in the new government, and the man who is speaking for Britain at the meeting of the big five foreign ministers going on now in London. The supporters of the Bevin plan say that, above all, the men in the fighting services must have fair dues, as we say.
whatever the cost.
And they argue that in the long run, the policy will pay dividends, however much inconvenience it causes on the home front now. The critics say that the bed-in plan was introduced at a time when it was widely anticipated that the Pacific War would go on for many months after the European War was over, but it's now obsolete. I think the end of the argument is going to be that the bed-in plan is carried through with all sorts of special exceptions for skilled workers at a much faster tempo. But we're going to hear a lot more about it when Parliament meets again in a few weeks' time. And if Mr. Churchill expresses an opinion, as I think he certainly will, what he says is going to have a most significant influence on the debate. But perhaps you were under the impression that Mr. Churchill doesn't count anymore. Don't you believe it? As leader of His Majesty's opposition in the House of Commons, Mr. Churchill is still one of the most active and important figures in British politics. You must understand that. In his capacity as leader of the opposition, he actually received an official government salary, $10,000 a year. And even if he wasn't Mr. Churchill, with the Churchill prestige, Churchill personality, he'd still be a very influential figure. As it is, not even Mr. Churchill's bitterest political opponents question that Churchill is still the most dynamic figure in the British Parliament. When Churchill speaks, it's Churchill's words, not the new Prime Minister's, that get the top headlines in the paper. And it's quite amusing to see the new members of Parliament who defeated Mr. Churchill's candidates and found Mr. Churchill as peacetime Prime Minister at the polls. It's amusing to see them now, quite frankly, rushing into the chamber to get a good seat when the old boy gets to his seat and smiles across at them like a benevolent and patient uncle. Churchill is still the great master. And it was so typical of him that when he made his first speech in Parliament as a defeated Prime Minister, he scintillated with personal confidence, sage advice to his opponents, and good humour. And every new member in the House of Commons cheered with affectionate delight when Churchill told how a Yugoslav friend of his, hearing of his defeat at the polls, had made the remark, "Poor old Churchill, I suppose they'll shoot him now." To which Churchill commented, "I explained to my young friend that my sentence would be mitigated to various forms of hard labour." And I believe Churchill is more likely to put that labour into leading the opposition in Parliament than writing those war memoirs which everybody is offering $1 million for. You see. Now this is MacDonald Hastings saying goodbye to you from London.
You have been listening to a recording of London Letter by MacDonald Hastings, the well-known journalist and broadcaster. This program came to you from the British Broadcasting Corporation.